I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anelio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast. And John, the last time I saw our guest in person, she was wearing a very, what was the guy's name on Castle? She was wearing a Castle cosplay looking outfit where she had a bulletproof vest that said Writer on it.
Yes.
I still have it.
Well, that's Patrick. He's an author and a podcaster. You can follow him on Twitter at ATFMB. And my name is John Anelio, and I'm a musician and a podcaster. You can follow me on Twitter at John Anelio. And that voice you hear is Sherry Priest. Sherry is the author of 20 books and novellas, including the recent haunted house thriller The Family Plot, acclaimed gothic author horror novel Maplecroft from Rock, and the award-winning Clockwork Century series from Tor. Sherry, thank you for joining us today.
Yay, thank you for having me.
The new book, The Family Plot, which I have a copy of right here. I had to go run to the other room and get it. just to prove it's like, I have it, see? This was actually a pick of the week from one of our recent guests, Liana Renee Heber.
Love her. She is so fantastic in every way.
She was a great guest, and she picked it. And as we were talking about it, I'm like, it's been a while since we have Sherry on the show. And then she's like, you should have her on again. I'm like, you're right. So I emailed Sherry, and here we go. So now we have Sherry on the show.
And, yeah. And it's all Liana's fault.
It is. But we're happy that she met you. I believe the last time that we had Sherry on the show, and I'm thinking about it now because you're wearing it's sort of a gaming headset kind of that you have going on.
It's one of my husband's old ones, actually.
Yeah, because I believe
I stole it from him.
Yeah, when we had Sherry on last, which was quite a few years ago now, I believe you were on with Sam Sykes, and I believe there was a lot of talk of Skyrim. Just to put how long ago that was.
And by the way, I just got a text from Sam, and he's saying buy his book.
Yes.
Oh, right. Well, yes, in accordance with the law, we have to get a text from Sam. I remember that. I'm trying to remember where it was and when exactly it was. But no, this is just the thing that I steal, that it's basically mine now for interviews like these. It's just much easier than trying to talk into the mic, you know.
No, it's good. It's good for that. You know, we were talking about Sam, not to make it all about him, but I just read an article with him because he has got a Pathfinder book coming out, which I think is really interesting. And one of the things that I know James Sutter, who is the, I believe, I don't know what his official title is, creative director.
He has a very fancy title now.
Yeah. So it's really interesting because, you know, obviously Tor is working with Pathfinder now. And I know one of the things that James wanted to do is that to get some authors that have their own sort of creator owned stuff out there, to get them to write some Pathfinder books too, because it's not something you often see. So to have them go. So Sam's book is coming out pretty soon. And I know Max Gladstone has a Pathfinder book that's coming down. And I am very interested because I like the Pathfinder books and I like Sam and I like Max Gladstone. Stone's work, so I'm really curious to read like their take on doing that kind of thing.
And just to throw it out there, with the new deal with Tor for distribution, they are also able now to kind of lure more established authors. Well, I hate saying more established.
No, I know what you're saying.
But you get what I'm saying. It's like more, I don't know, mainstream authors who have written other things. You know, people who normally you wouldn't expect to write what's considered to be a tie-in novel.
Right.
But Sam absolutely fits in with the whole Pathfinder idea and concept because he writes Sword and Sorcery. And I think that fits really, really well with Pathfinder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would be interested to see Max's work because he has such a unique world that he's built on his own with his Craft Sequence books, which I really like, which are really very literary and very bizarre and out there. Yeah.
So now that we've spent, you know, 5-6 minutes talking about stuff that's not Sherry's books.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah. No, but it just made me think of that. But it brings up a good point because Sherry has managed to keep changing up what she's doing. So now the new book, The Family Plot, which is out through Tor, I believe Liana described this as like a ghost story book. And I don't know if that's the way. So maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about this particular book, and then we can get into some of the other things you're doing, because everything you've done has been different. It's not like you've done the same thing over. You've had different series that have, you know, kind of went across genres and been their own thing. So maybe tell a little bit of something about the new one.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're right. Like anytime anyone says, "Hey, I read your book," they mean Bone Shaker, which was now like 8 or 9 books ago.
And right. it's usually on people's like best of lists.
Right. And I appreciate that. I really do. I'm not, you know, hating on steampunk or anything. It bought me a house. So believe me, I have nothing but gratitude for the entire experience. But as steampunk kind of started to kind of wind down there a few years ago, I decided, well, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to go back to horror, which is kind of where I got my start anyway. And I did the Lizzie Borden books, which were either really high concept or really low concept, depending on how you looked at it. Like, it was either a 19th century Gothic epistolary told, basically a version of Dracula told via Lovecraft, you know, or it was Lizzie Borden fighting Cthulhu with an axe. Like, you know, kind of take your pick. But after spending a lot of time kind of doing the genre mash and trying to put a new spin on different things and trying to collide ideas together, I decided it was kind of time to just get back to basics. I moved back to Tennessee, I guess about coming up on 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And I live in this little Victorian neighborhood that's at the foot of Lookout Mountain. And it was the site of a lot of action during the Civil War. And in the 1880s, there was a yellow fever plague that drove a lot of people here trying to escape it, and they didn't all succeed. And I mean, like basically, if my neighborhood isn't haunted, there's no such thing as ghosts. but there are so many crazy, like just wacky pants stories that my neighbors tell me, because reality is always so much weirder than anything I'm going to come up with anyway. And I thought, you know, I just want to write a Southern Gothic haunted house story, just a straightforward, no frills. I wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel. I just really like wheels. I wanted to tell a good wheel and just have it be just this one really straightforward thing. And so we've done a lot of work on this old house that we bought. and we knew it needed work. I don't think we were really prepared for the scope of how much work the house needed. at this point, nothing else is allowed to go wrong. We're just out of money to throw at it. But no, it was great. But we had to restore some old retaining walls because we're on kind of a grade here. And one day a neighbor of mine calls me over to the fence, and he's hilarious. I love the guy. But he's like, "So y'all are new here, right?" And I'm like, "Well, I mean, you know, we just moved back." And he's like, "No, to the neighborhood." And I was like, "Yeah, I guess." He's like, "Well, you got to learn the rules for the neighborhood." And I'm like, "Okay." He's like, "No, here it is. All right. When you start digging in your yard, you're going to find shit." Okay. That's exactly how he's like, "You're going to find shit." And he's like, it's going to be mostly like buttons and bullets and little buckles and things. He says, "That's for you. You keep that. You put it on a mantle." And he looks around to make sure his kids can't hear. And he's like, "You find human remains, you put that shit back where you found it. You don't say a goddamn word." I'm like, okay. But I mean, like, this was Cherokee ground for a long, long time, obviously. And then the war happened and then all these other things. And he's like, "Look, you see that street up there? That's the line where the National Park Service ends. If they think you have Civil War dead, they may come and tear up your yard and try and bring them out." He's like, "If you think you found Native remains, the way that kind of people in the neighborhood come at it is, you know, they put them where they want them, leave them alone. Don't bother them. And if it really bothers you, the Cherokee Nation still has a large presence here in the Tennessee Valley. You can contact them and they will come do a removal if it bothers you that much. But generally speaking, just leave it alone. Just leave it alone. You didn't see anything, you know, like the penguins, you know." And he was half joking, but, you know, half not too. And this neighborhood, there's only like 630 buildings in the historic district itself, including the houses and the little old businesses and things. So it's a very finite space. But it was a neighborhood that had seen some really hard times, really up until about the last 10 or 15 years. It was really kind of hit and miss and sort of sketchy. But some other neighbor, was telling me another story about a house in the neighborhood that kind of just... often when I'm going to start to work on a project, there's like three or four ideas that kind of roll around and sort of collide and stick like Katamari style. And eventually you have a bundle big enough to start working with. So that conversation with the one neighbor was part of it. And a conversation with another neighbor about an old house was another part of it. And it was one of those things that was just so strange that once I knew it was a thing that had really happened, I could not not use it for a book. Different neighbor was telling. So there was this great old house that was falling down, and this is only a few streets away from me. And back in the 80s, this guy bought it. He was going to fix it up, and he went to the city, and he said, "Hey, I need to put in a driveway here," because there was no formal road or drive to it. This is the South. everything is kind of informal in a lot of regards.
Oh yeah, you can't get there from here.
Yeah, you can't get there from here. So he goes to the city, and they're like, "You can't put a driveway there. There's a cemetery there." And he's like, "No, there isn't. I didn't buy a cemetery." And they're like, "Yeah, you did. Here's the map. There's an open cemetery on that plot." And he wigs out. So he goes to the woman who kind of facilitated the deal. She was a member of the family that had owned the house and was, I think, acting with power of attorney. She still lives in this neighborhood. I know for a fact that some of what I'm telling you is true. So he goes to her and he's like, "Hey, why didn't you tell me there was a cemetery on the grounds?" And she's like, "There's not a..." Oh, shit. Oh, that, you know. She's like, okay. Good news. It's not a cemetery. I know it looks like it was a cemetery. Because the guy went back and he starts digging around and finds all these tombstones that have fallen over. Most of them from the early 1920s. And he's just completely freaking out about it. She's like, "No, listen, my family, since about the 1890s, has owned a monument company here in Chattanooga. They do plaques, they do memorials, and they do tombstones. And back in the 1920s, this woman's great-grandfather got this great idea to throw a massive Halloween party. So he took a bunch of unclaimed or unfinished tombstones from work, set them up in the side yard, and threw a big party. Tombstones are heavy. And Grandpa just didn't feel like putting them back, so we left them there. And like everybody in the neighborhood knew for years and years that that was not a real cemetery, you know. But as the neighborhood demographics changed, as people moved out and new people moved in, people just kind of assumed it was a little family plot attached to this old family house, and nobody knew the difference. So as it turned out, at some point in the 1950s, a census worker had come through and seen it and had recorded it as part of the census, which meant that it was a legally open cemetery on this private land. So the guy who buys the house in the 80s, he goes down to the historic zoning people again, and he's like, "Good news, it's not a cemetery." And this woman says it's not, and she would know. And they're like, "Well, you can't prove it." And he's like, "Well, I could go dig it up." And they said, "You can't go digging there. That's an open cemetery." So it's this massive catch-22 for this dude. And eventually the woman, using the family's power of attorney, legally closed the cemetery so that he could do whatever he wanted and put in the driveway. And this is where it gets a little murky, because according to neighborhood lore, it was like on day three or four that they turned up human remains.
Oh, boy.
So my question is, did Grandpa have a long game? You know, like, or was it like Civil War related or Native related, or like what the hell? This was literally like three blocks from my house. And knowing this, I'm like, how can I not tell a story about that?
Right.
So what actually happened to the house, though, as this other neighbor was telling me, is like, yeah, you know, it sat vacant until like right before I moved here in 2012. And in 2011, there was a really big storm that came and actually just took down the house. Basically, it did a lot of damage in this neighborhood. And he's like, you know, the sad thing is it had just been bought by this lesbian couple. And as everyone knows, lesbians are exceptional renovators. We were really looking forward to seeing what they were going to do with the place. And I'm just like...
I've been watching a little too much Modern Family.
Well, no, my neighborhood is actually kind of a little bit of a hippie enclave. It's a little blue dot and a little purple city and a little red state, you know. Because as the neighborhood was finally starting to turn around, it was a bunch of artists and teachers and you know, kind of free thinking folks who bought these old houses to kind of fix them up and live in them. So anyway, fortunately for those nice ladies, the house was fully insured, because when they do the historic loans on these places, you take out the loan for the value of the house plus what it's going to take to bring it to code and what you're going to do with it. So the insurance covers the full length of that loan. So they just rebuilt. And now where there used to be a cemetery that wasn't a cemetery but might have been a cemetery, there is a swimming pool. Shit thee not.
So it's like if it was a cemetery, they're pushing their poltergeist luck.
They really are. They really are.
Exactly the plot of Poltergeist, right?
I know.
They put the pool in.
Well, and like that was kind of a joke in the neighborhood for a while, because I think they're from the region, but not from the city. And like, do they just not know about this house? Maybe someone should tell them. And the only bad thing that's happened to them since moving there, though, somebody broke into the place. But the funny thing about this breaking and entering, they have several little tiny dogs. And when they came home, they found that somebody had gotten the fire extinguisher and used it to chase the little dogs into a back room and close the door. So it's like, well, if you're going to break it into somebody's house, I mean, don't hurt their dogs.
Right. You
know? So they're like, well, I guess, you know, it could have been worse. They didn't hurt the dogs. They just closed them in the back room. But I say all that to say this. So I'm also a big fan of reality TV, not like The Bachelorette, but more like HGTV and DIY and the Travel Channel. And there's this wonderful show called Salvage Dogs. It's set out of Black Dog Salvage in Roanoke, Virginia. And it's a little family run operation. And I was thinking one day, you know, like, I bet these guys have a lot of great ghost stories, because everybody talks about how renovation and remodeling is the, you know, it stirs up ghosts if you're living in a house and you start working on it, you know.
Yep, that's like, what Supernatural has taught us after 27 seasons.
After all this time, yeah. Yes. We should know this by now. But I thought, you know, surely breaking one down. And I know that these projects sometimes take several days or even a week or more. And so I started noodling around with a book that became The Family Plot, kind of combining everything that I just told you into this one story. And the funny thing was, when I was nearly done with the manuscript, my husband was out of town. I was sitting at home by myself, glass or two or three of wine, and Salvage Dogs comes on. And at the very end of it, there's this thing like, hey, do you like our show? Send us an email, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to send them an email. So I'm sitting on my phone drunk, emailing Salvage Talks. Like, hi, guys, I'm a writer. No, like, I'm like a real writer. Like, here's my Wikipedia page. Like, people know I do things. I wrote a book. I mean, I'm writing a book. And I just wanted to talk to somebody from your company. I just have some really specific questions about the salvage industry. And I was wondering if I just talked to somebody for just like 20 minutes. And I'm not some rando, I swear to God. And I hit send. And in the morning, I felt really stupid about it, because I'd had to submit this through a form. Like, I didn't even have a copy of the email. I couldn't even go look and see how stupid I had been. I just had to remember having been kind of stupid with my phone. But I had an email first thing in the morning from the general manager of the shop saying, you know what? I check this email inbox about once a week, and it's always full of people going, how do I start my own salvage company? And I always send them the let me Google that for you link. In a form letter. He's like, but nobody has ever asked me this before. Go ahead. Here's my phone number. Give me a call around lunchtime. So I sat on the phone with this guy for like an hour, and he was lovely. And we got nerdy about old houses and the like. And I mean, most of what I know about old houses comes from the restoration angle. My dad used to work on old houses when I was a kid too. And now I have an old house that we've been working on. But just the actual business of how they go about making these deals and working these deals and what they can reasonably expect to pay for certain things, you know. Because I needed a deal for a small company that was a little too good to be true, but like not so good to be true that nobody would ever think it was, right, you know, really worth doing. And something that somebody would take a big risk on. And so I thanked that guy and the acknowledgments for it. And I really appreciated them dealing with my drunk ass self and my ridiculous questions on the phone. But anyway, that's where The Family Plot came from me moving back to Tennessee and hearing lots of silly stories and liking old houses.
That's great. Thank you for sharing all that. A couple of things that you said there that stuck out. First of all, you said this, and I don't even know if you're aware that you said it, but I think it's a great quote now. I'm going to try to remember it when we're done. You said, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. I just really like wheels.
I just like wheels.
I think that's a great quote for people. That's great. But another question I had for you is, you described it as Southern Gothic, and that's a term I've heard quite a bit. What makes something Southern Gothic? Because obviously Gothic means something.
Well,
I'm not from the South. I'm not from the South. So
it's okay.
I would like to know what constitutes, because it's something that I'm interested in, but I don't know exactly what it means typically.
Well, like me and Leanna, Renee Heber have actually talked about this at length, because we are both fans of the Gothic in a broad sense. And, and then when you start to kind of, you know, splinter it off into different things, it's like, so much of what makes Gothic is the setting as a character, the setting and the atmosphere of dread, of oppression, And you move this a setting of dread and oppression to the south, which is really easy to do, as it turns out. And there's very often some complicated family elements at play. And I realize that sounds like a broad thing to say, but people like to joke about how everyone in the South is related. And I don't think, for all that I have 1,001 cousins, I think it's just that we cop to more relatives than a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. Like, I have third and fourth cousins who I just call my cousins.
Yeah, I do too. And people always,
you know,
go,
what I mean?
I'll say my cousin said this, or my cousin did that, or my cousin blah, blah, blah. And people are going, how many cousins do you have?
Yeah, like, probably no more than you do. Yeah. It's just that, like,
we call them cousins.
And you tend to know them all.
Yeah.
And because everybody kind of still lives in the same region. But that does lead to complicated family allegiances and resentments and alliances and bonds and things that, and grudges. Yes. Which comes up in the family plot, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated 4-person setup, basically, that is complicated by a divorce and who's still friends with who and so forth and so on. But there is very, very often that sense of complicated family ties that are complicated further by family secrets and by things that people haven't said and the things that are hidden.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I'm reading this really great book right now called Ghostland by a guy named Colin Dickey, and it's fantastic. It's like this guy and me have such similar sentiments with regards to kind of a philosophy of haunting and ghosts and folklore. And he says something in one of his chapters about places that are hidden and yet welcome. Like, they're hiding from you and yet they're welcoming you. And that tension is something that you find a great deal in Gothic literature in general. But in the Southern sense too, there's this idea of, you know, there was a failed revolution here. The South lives literally in the wreckage of a revolution that failed. And there was splendor and there was horror, and it's all still kind of here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a McDonald's, I think, out in Red Bank that still has a Civil War marker in the parking lot. You know, like we're living on a graveyard here. So the South in general is a very good place to kind of parlay the Gothic and make it a little more modern in some regards.
And there's like long memories too.
Oh my God!
Like the Hatfields and McCoys, John.
Well, that was West Virginia.
I know,
that was West Virginia.
Still, but it's still considered South. But it's
no,
like,
no, they seceded from this so that they.
But
I mean, come
on,
give West Virginia
to.
Credit,
on who
man.
You talk to. But mm-hmm. it's that kind of thought, right? It's that kind of thing that still goes on. You know, I remember, and I don't think any of my family listens to this podcast. If they do, I'm screwed at this point. I remember sitting in a car at a funeral, and my aunt and uncle are sitting in the front, and my mom and I are sitting in the back, and my aunt is ridiculously upset because one of my cousins was doting on her father. And it was because he was very upset over this funeral. And my aunt's just going on and on and on about, you know, how much it upsets her that she dotes on this man who's not her real father. And my mom's going, Judy, Patrick's in the car, Patrick's in the car. Because it's this huge family secret.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that kind of stuff throughout the South. It's like there's all this weird stuff.
Oh yeah. Well, and like I was saying a minute ago about like the complicated family things. I was at a funeral when I was a little bitty kid for this guy everybody called Uncle Bonnie, and his name was not Bonnie, but I don't know, Scottish ancestry or something. Everybody called him Uncle Bonnie. And at some point in this funeral, I asked my mom exactly how we were related to this guy, because I'd never met him before. I didn't know who the hell he was. And it turned out it was something ridiculous. Like, he was my great great aunt's half stepfather or something ridiculous like that. And I was like, and when I tried to spell it out, like, so he's great aunt so-and-so's second husband's son or something like that. And my mom was like, don't you talk that way about him.
Right. Yeah.
And I remember being very confused by this. Like, I'm just trying to figure out like what's happening here.
John, have you ever been to the South at all?
Have I ever been to what?
The South.
The South.
Just like driving through. I have never spent any particular like the time down there.
There are definitely places that it feels like there's a mood,
mm-hmm. yeah,
in the place. And I think that also lends itself to be the Gothic thing.
You know,
like
you're walking through a touristy place, and it's a touristy place, and there's lots of people, and it's hot, and you want an ice cream.
Yes.
But then you go off the beaten path, and you're at some ancient looking place, and you feel that. I don't know, that presence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You were talking about, like how you'd lived out near Chickamauga at the dam. Out at the battlefield, there's this place called Snodgrass Hill, mm-hmm. and it's this horseshoe-shaped hill. And if you go up onto this hill, you can press these buttons on these monuments, and they have people reading, like actors. I think they're actors. Surely they're not the real people. Reading from the journals of the soldiers who fought on the battlefield, talking about what happened where you're standing right now. And the park guides will tell you to not get off the beaten path, because what happened at the Battle of Chickamauga is that it took like 6 weeks to finish burying all the bodies, and they just buried them where they fell. So if you step off the main beaten track out into the trees, you know, you're going to break an ankle with all of the sunken graves and stuff. So just don't do that. Yeah. And the funny thing about Snodgrass Hill, and I wrote a short story about it a really long time ago. It was like one of my first things that was ever published. But the funny thing about it, like the first time or two I went there, it's like you get out of the car, because there's a little parking loop, like at the top of the hill and one at the bottom of the hill. And you get up at the top of the hill and it's just dead silent. I mean, it's a wooded hill and there's no birds. There's no chipmunks and there's no bugs. It's just like the singularly most oppressive place I have ever been in my life. And I thought it was just me. And then a friend of mine, Andrea, came out to visit once, and she has a pair of Dobermans and Tink and Beowulf. And they were in the back. And so we drive up to Snodgrass Hill because she's walking them out at the battlefield. People like to walk their dogs. They like to ride bikes there. And we pull up to the top of Snodgrass Hill and she opens the back and the dog started whining and lay down and refused to get out of the vehicle. And I was like, it is not just me. See, it's not just me. Even the dog, like, I know something's wrong. The dogs know something's wrong. There's something wrong here.
Even like being on the lake, like the little islands.
Well, because TVA created them. Yeah. I mean, they back flooded all that. So now there's all these little islands that didn't used to be islands. Yeah. They just used hills.
Yeah. And they feel creepy to me. Mm-hmm.
You know, you were talking about all the stuff with families and everything, and I've read a lot of nonfiction recently, and I feel like this was in one of the Charles Duhigg books I read. He wrote these books about habits and all these sort of social science kind of books I read. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he was talking about with, depending on your background, how so much of like your genealogy does actually have an impact on how you act. You could be. And one of the things was if you come from, they were doing these studies and it was, I believe it was people that had sort of a Scottish, Irish kind of background, which I think a lot of people in the South.
The honor culture. I think I know what you're talking about. I'm familiar with
this. This was the thing where they were talking about the difference between people who were, say, farmers versus the people who like were herders, who had goats and things like that. Mm-hmm. So if you're a farmer, and your livelihood is based on your crops. Well, people don't really go and steal your crops because they're really, no. You kind of can't. But someone can come and steal your goats. Like, mm-hmm. That's a thing. So if you have, you know, hundreds and thousands of years of you being a herder and you are constantly on the defensive for someone coming and stealing your goat, you had a very sort of defending your honor or defending your property kind of thing going on. And so they did these studies with people who had this sort of background, and they were much more likely, they would like do these things where like someone would walk by and sort of mutter like, hey, jerk, or something like that, where there'd be some sort of
more reactive.
Yes.
In general.
And they like sort of like had them hooked up to all these sorts of different, medical scanners and things. And it's like, you know, their blood pressure would be up and they literally had a much stronger physical reaction than someone that kind of came from. And they did talk about why, and I believe he brought up the Hatfields and the McCoys too, about how that wouldn't end, because it was just always like people like, you killed this many, now we got to go and kill this. And it's that
sort of John, there's been conversations where it's like, you know, oh, we don't talk to them.
Yeah, like, we still don't talk to them.
Why not?
Something that happened 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's like, why not? Well, Mama said we don't talk to them. Mama's been dead for 60 years.
Right, exactly. But like, I mean, Lord, like, okay, my grandmother, well, I'll say this. The Hatfields and the McCoys are like the famous feuding hillbillies.
Yeah.
There were another couple of families, the Martins and the McCoys, that were in Kentucky out in Hazard County. In fact, Disney went ahead when they did their hillbilly cartoon, used the Martins and the McCoys, because the Hatfields and the McCoys were very litigious by the 20th century and like to sue anybody. I'm serious. Mm-hmm. So there's a Ballad of the Martins and the McCoys that kind of goes with that little Disney cartoon. Okay, my grandma's a McCoy. Mm-hmm. And they ended up actually... like they had a big feud going on and it ended kind of around the turn of the century, give or take. And the family fragmented, but both Martins and the McCoys were cousins. They were the only two families who'd been in this valley for like four generations. They had either intermarried or not. And either way, it just wasn't good. But her family all ended up out, her branch of it all ended up out in Iowa. And they still like tell stories through the family of things that happened in Kentucky. And that one time that where everybody went back to read the will and they took the train. And I mean, just these crazy long memories, even long after you're gone.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, but like, I mean, like everybody remembers in this neighborhood, it's like people, the old timers will point to a house. Well, you know, in that house, what happened was,
Yeah.
And that's changing as the neighborhood changes. But oh my God, this is too awesome. So there's this one house that sat on the market like way longer than it, because I mean, even the shitholes like go fast around here. People are snatching them up to take care of them. And it just didn't sell and didn't sell and didn't sell. And so now there's this couple that's redoing it. And I ran into her, the female half of this couple while I was walking the dogs and we got talking. She's like, yeah, well, you know, we really wanted to get into the neighborhood and we did a lot of soul searching and we decided we just weren't that worried about the ghost. And I was like, what? There's a ghost in this house? She's like, oh, I don't know, but probably. And I said, why? And she's like, oh, so like you didn't. Okay. Here's the thing. The nice old man who lived in this house for like 70 years died in this house. And it took so long for them to find his body that by the time they did, it was classified as like a biohazard and it had to be disclosed by the realtor.
Yeah.
And so no one would buy the house. She's like, oh, we had to pull up like 10 square feet of flooring and remove a joist. I mean, like he had basically just melted through the floor by the time anybody discovered him. And I was like, wow.
Do you know that? Wow. So I worked in the mortgage industry for many, many years. One of the things that they do have to disclose as a realtor to you is if the house is haunted.
In some states, it's my understanding that that's not true in every state.
You are correct. It is in some states, but I know for I think in Colorado, they have to tell you.
Well, here they mostly have to tell you about biohazards because of all the meth labs. I'm serious.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
They have to tell you if the house had been used as a meth lab or something like that. But his corpse qualified as a biohazard by the time they were trying to sell the house.
When my uncle owned a business in California and he sold it and he had to do something with the money. So he bought a business in New Mexico that was supposed to be his retirement business. And then he didn't really work out. And he ended up selling that business, moving to Colorado. And he thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a couple of houses and just rent them out and use the money that way. And so he ended up buying like it used to be an old hotel kind of thing that someone had converted into apartments and it had a couple of houses on it. So he bought that and started fixing it up. And he had this house on the grounds and he got this really nice couple and they moved into the house and they kind of watched over things for him. And he just absolutely adored them. They were the greatest people. They always paid the rent on time. He never had any complaints from them or about them. It was just wonderful. And then one day the cops called because they were cooking meth in that house this whole time for like a year. And he went in and he's like, oh, great. And so they got it all out and the cops go, oh, and by the way, you basically have to strip this house down now and get rid of everything.
You got to take out the drywall.
So he had to strip it down completely and essentially rebuild the whole thing inside because of the meth.
Yep. Oh, when we first moved to Seattle, we were watching TV with some friends. It was like CSI or something. And, you know, the cops like push open the door and they got their flashlights and there's all these pots and pans and burbling things on the stoves. And our friends are like, what's that? My husband and I are like, it's a meth lab. And they were like, how do you know? We're like, we're from Tennessee. We've got those there. But no, Lord, I mean, like if you want to start ghost stories, we'll be here all damn day. But I mean, I did a post a couple of years ago that I tend to point people at called How to Tell a True Ghost Story, kind of off of the Tim O'Brien, How to Tell a True War Story, that kind of folds in a couple of the ones that I know from around here. But and people always ask about our house, like if it's haunted. And I'm like, you know, I really don't think it is. It was built as like a seasonal bungalow sometime after 1895 and before 1904. Thank you, Southern Record Keeping. Well, the deed says 1920, but that's the year that the city annexed our neighborhood, and it's the first year it appeared on the tax rolls. So, but the Historic Society survey people said that it was here by 1904. But in the 1930s, it was added on to, and then again in the 1950s, it was added on to. And like this was never a family home, and it was vacant for a decade or two at a time here and there. And I actually have old friends who are like, yeah, we used to go like looking in the old houses in St. Elmo. You know, we go in the middle of the night and try and like let ourselves into the old ones that nobody lived in. I think I've been in your house before. Literally, when I threw a Halloween party a couple years ago, one of my old friends was like, I'm pretty sure I've been in this house, man. Like, thanks. I know.
There's
you could get in under the house. There's like a crawl space with a door that you could just open the door and go under the house. And until the remodel that happened in, I think, 2006 or seven by the people we bought it from, there was a little set of stairs. You could just climb up into the house from under the house.
Nice.
And nobody lived here, so nobody cared.
Cool. Well,
so John, yeah. I don't know if you're aware of this. We've been talking for like 30 minutes and we haven't even been fixed yet.
Well, that's what I think. No. We do that sometimes. Whereas, like, if we get on a roll, then I'm like, well, we'll do picks last. That's fine. So,
well, I work from home by myself. It's like, oh my God, people to talk to. you guys.
I work with elementary school children, so I don't have anybody to talk to either.
So you get me talking about Southern stuff, and you and I think are having a great conversation about Southern stuff. I'll just keep going.
I do enjoy when we have people who have some Southern expertise because it brings that out in Patrick. we'll do some quick picks to round it up. Before we get into that, I just do want to mention that if you enjoy the show, if you like these sorts of conversations with cool folks like Sherry, then consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We'd like to thank all the people who back us already. It makes a big difference and it really means a lot to us. But if you're someone who listens to the show, gets value out of the show, please consider becoming one of our backers. You can kick us $1 a month, whatever works for you. And it really helps us out a lot. If you can't afford to do that, you can help us out by recommending us to a friend. Be like, hey man, you like all of them science fiction and fantasy novels and stuff, why don't you listen to this show, because they'll have cool people on it that you'll like. Or you can give us a review on iTunes or something like that. That all helps, so please consider doing that. But let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And I was directed to go first because I think Sherry and Patrick need to think about it for a moment.
No, I've got one now.
Oh, you got one. Good. Well, Sherry, you go first then. Why don't you go first?
Okay, I'll go first. My husband was out of town for work, and so me and Netflix had a grand old time. I kept seeing recommended all over Twitter this show out of Australia and New Zealand called Clever Man. And it's only, I think, 6 or 7 episodes, but I sat and mainlined it. It's absolutely phenomenal.
Oh.
It's really, 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 really good. And it got me and a couple other people talking about the cunning man in like British and UK folklore, where there's and how that parlays into the witch figure of women and so forth and so on. But basically your shaman, your wizard, your whatever guy. But it's all based out of Aboriginal faiths and lore and culture, and it's kind of a near future sci-fi that is a little urban fantasy esque, and it's a really, really, really nice study in characters who you're pretty sure you understand, and then by the end of it you realize you had it all wrong. And I strongly recommend it. They've started working on a second season, and it is called Clever Man, and you can get it on Netflix.
That keeps popping up in my recommended too.
Me too. When I was watching Luke Cage, every time I'd finish an episode of Luke Cage, it'd be like, it would go right to Clever Man, and I'm like, I should watch that.
Yeah, but the pilot is solid, but I always give everything 3 episodes because a pilot, I mean, you know, that's gone through 50 committees, and seriously, give it a couple episodes. It's very, very good.
But that's good. Cool. So it's from Australia, you said, and it's based on the Aboriginal. Yeah, that's because I'm always really interested in that part of the world, especially with like New Zealand and the Maori and the.
Have you seen the Babadook yet?
No, I haven't. I kept meaning to, and I missed it. But Clever Man does a really nice job of something that people are talking about a lot in sci-fi, of like, well, let's actually talk about what's really going on in the real world and race issues and cultural issues and how protectionism and nationalism and business interests and all kinds of things kind of collide and collude in ways that are very, very hard on certain groups of people and how they fight back and how they push back and what they have at their disposal to fight the powers that be. And it's really, really strong, and I'm really, really excited to hear they're doing a second season. And like I said, there's only 6 or 7 episodes. You can sit and mainline it in an afternoon if you got nothing better to do.
That is really cool. I will have to check that out because I was interested in that one. I'm going to pick a Netflix or a show that I watched on Netflix too, which I think I might have picked when the first season was out, but now the second season has been up on Netflix for about a month now, and that is Dark Matter, which is a show that's on the Sci-Fi Channel. And I loved the first season, and I just finished the second season last night. They're, I think, 13 episodes each season, and your typical Sci-Fi Channel, length of like 43 minutes an episode. It's great. I really like it. It's first of all, I'm a huge Stargate fan, and it is from
Joseph
Malazzi and Paul Mulley, I believe, is the other random. So If you liked Stargate, you'll enjoy this because it has a very similar vibe in terms of the writing and the acting. And if you watched all that Stargate, you will see familiar faces pop up. So Tori Higginson, who is on Stargate Atlantis, is a recurring character. David Hewlett is a small character on a couple of episodes. You see a lot of the same creative team in terms of the directors and stuff. So you see Peter DeLuise directed a bunch of episodes. Amanda Tapping, who was what was the name of her character in Stargate? Carter. Yeah, she directed a bunch of episodes. So it's, you know, one of those Vancouver science fiction shows, which I love all those. So it's, you know, you see a lot of familiar faces in that. So it's great, and it is a very, in my mind, a very writing driven show.
Yeah.
It's a smaller budget. I think they spend their budget wisely when they do have their special effects. I feel like this spaceship battles and stuff, you know, they're in small doses, but they look pretty good when you see them there. But it's a very, you know, plot writing, character driven show. So you get really into it. It's some pretty good, pretty intellectual ideas for a Sci-Fi Channel show, I think, and it's really enjoyable. So,
and the second season, I thought like really brought it. I mean, like first season was fun, and the second season really kind of, I agree. Is a lot. Oh, and also Killjoys, which is also the other sci-fi, which is also a lot.
I watched season one of that, I haven't gotten to season.
Is
two
Dark Matter the one where they all wake up and they don't know who they are?
Yes, that's the one.
Have you seen the thing that's going around where each number corresponds to a specific? Oh my gosh, what was it? Was it a personality or was it like an emotional state? Like each one of them. Oh no, it was I know what it was. Character classes in Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, really?
Well, all right.
So like number 1 is lawful good. Number 2 is such and such, number 3 excuse me, such and such.
Yeah.
I didn't know
I could buy that. No, I hadn't, but that
don't die, Patrick. Yeah, don't die.
But it's really good. They play with that a lot with the memories, and they do, you know.
I love the android. She's my favorite, actually.
Yeah, mine too. The android and they really get into her character more in the second season, where they really play with that a lot more. It's just really good. They really take a lot of like the tropes of sci-fi, but present them in a new way, and it's just really good. It is worth your time for sure. Ooh, and it's up on Netflix.
Can I do one more?
Yeah.
Yes, go for it.
The Exorcist on Fox is so freaking good.
I have heard that.
I was like, this is, no, we don't need this. Do not do this. No, it's really, 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 really good. And I want them to make more of it. And the ratings aren't spectacular. And I want everyone to watch it.
And they just had a massive reveal not too long ago.
Yes,
I'm not going to spoil, but that really tied it to the movies.
Yes. And in a way that, like, if you told me they were going to do that at episode 1, I would have been like, how freaking corny. But by the time it came around, it was perfect. And I promise I'll shut up. I just really, really love it.
No, I've heard other people say that is just it's a standout show that they didn't expect to be that good either. The other one that I'll throw out there that I did not expect to be that good is Lethal Weapon.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
I've been ridiculously impressed with that show. I never would have thought they could do that.
I think everybody thought that was going to be DOA.
Yeah.
You know?
Like the MacGyver reboot.
Oh my God, don't even get me started.
Terrible.
That's a horrible show.
It's just so unfortunate. Just like there's a lot of talent on the show, and I'm just like, oof.
I watched the new MacGyver and I went, this is just Scorpion badly written.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think what people are real, what people who make these things realize is that, you know, if you're just smart, people are smart that are watching this stuff. So don't treat them like idiots, and you can make it good. So because you have a lot of these kind of reboots and properties that people are like, do we need a Bates Motel? Do we need a Hannibal show? And
who thought that was going to be good? But my God.
Exactly. So it's like, yeah, if you just do a really good job on the writing and get some good talent in there, you can really make this stuff good. Like don't dumb it down for people. Like, you know, just make it good. Patrick, what is your pick this week then?
So my pick this week, I'm going to go with Dynamite Comics, Dresden Files Wild Card.
Okay.
So I don't know if I think I've kind of talked about this before, but Butcher has this deal with Dynamite where they have been turning his novels into comic books.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But he has also done several now original stories for the comics that bridge between the novels.
that's a really good use of graphic novels in a universe. Like, yeah. That's what I was going to ask, if it was just simply like sort of the tie-in, or if it was like an original story.
It's he's done several original stories now. And I forget which books this one is in between. It might be White Knight and the next one, but he's done several of these where in the books you had the war that has started, right? And you have the White Council and the vampires and the Red Court and the Black Court and all this kind of stuff. So he had a book in between those books. He had an original story that he did for Dynamite that kind of talked about how, because they talk a little bit about it, or he does in the books, about what Dresden has had to do as part of that war as one of the wardens now. But he actually had an original story that showed him as a warden having to take wizards and train them and go off and do battle. So there was one of those. He had another one that was set, it was like Christmas in Downtown, and it was Dresden and Molly have to go downtown, which is the underworld, right? And stop like a killer. And now you have Wild Cards, which is after Gentleman Marcone becomes a signer of the Uncelia Accords and a protector of Chicago. Someone comes to Chicago and starts pitting the different factions against each other. Marcone against the White Court against Marcone, the cops against everybody, and like hunting people. And it's up to Dresden and Thomas and Molly and Karen Murphy to figure out what the hell's going on. And then something starts hunting Murphy. And it's just it's a really good story. I like it. And again, it's set in the Dresden Files, and it's before like a new novel comes out. So it's like a great little bridge if you're a fan of those books, which I am. I love those books. And Jim is now local to Colorado, so I feel comfortable calling him Jim. instead of Mr.
Pleasant Butcher. Fellow.
Yes. Yes, yes. I heard a story about him at a con on a Segway.
Probably. Yeah.
Like he was specifically at the Wordfire booth, I guess, signing, and he somehow got a hold of a Segway. And when he wasn't at the booth, he would just kind of ride by on the Segway and wave at them, pause, back up, wave again, go forward, wave again, and just like messing with them at the booth. It was hilarious. So yeah, he's pretty fun.
Cool. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. So once again, I think Sherry did an awesome breakdown of why you should go get her new book, The Family Yay. Plot. So
and why you should apparently buy a house in St. Elmo.
That yes. too. So do that to increase the property value there. So yeah. So that's the new one, The Family Plot. It's out through Tor. It is available at hardback and ebook. Is there a audiobook for it as well?
Sure. Yes, I believe so.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. So go and check that out, but also go and check out some of our other books, the Maplecroft books from Rock and the Clockwork Century books from Tours. A lot of stuff out there and lots of different genre match. So something for you. So go and check that out. Sherry's website is sherrypriest.com. So Cherie priest.com. And you can follow her on Twitter at CMPriest. Any cons coming up, Sherry?
I'll be doing Confusion in Detroit, which I almost always do. And right. I'll be doing that's in January. Why they want to throw it in January in Detroit, I do not know. But I always have a great time, and I never have any trouble getting in or out of there. So right on. I'm also going to be doing LibertyCon, which is here in the Chattanooga in the spring. And I always do DragonCon, but I don't do nearly as much travel as I used to these days. Oh, and I'm doing the Steampunk Symposium thing in Ohio as well.
Cool. You mentioned Detroit in January. It's kind of like Capricorn in February in Chicago. Yeah, let's go to Chicago in February. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
Let's go.
But I'm telling you, I've never had any trouble getting in or out of there, and I have never once had a bad time in Michigan. It's one of my favorite events, and I always love to go there.
Cool.
So. Well, they always get a great roster of authors there.
It's kind of become like a social con for a lot of us. Like, some people don't even participate on programming. They just come out to hang out.
I feel like maybe about 5 years ago or so, one of the publishers maybe paid for a lot of authors to go out, like paid their way. So I think Angry Robot
did that a couple of times. Like they made
and it's largely it's a Bill, it's Subterranean kind of.
Oh,
it's Bill's Fief kind of.
Okay.
which I mean in the best possible way. He's yes. a wonderful host, him and Yanni and all of them. And
oh, maybe that's what I'm thinking. Maybe it was Subterranean, maybe to sort of stir up some interest. Then I feel like mm-hmm. they paid for a bunch to get out there. And now it's like a thing. So
well, I wonder who did it first, because Lee did that with Angry Robot, bringing a bunch of authors to WorldCon.
Yeah. No, that's sort of, but this is such a kind of an unusual idea, because it's like you said, sure. Detroit in January, like who wants to do it? But if you get enough good folks out there, mm-hmm. then it makes it much more appealing. So very good. Anything else you want to tell our listeners before we wrap it up then?
Nothing springs to mind, but thank you.
Yeah.
It's been a week.
Yes. Yes, it has. Yes, it has. So everyone else, Patrick, anything else you want to mention before we get rolling there?
No, I'm good. Just bless your heart, okay. Johnny.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I try.
Bless it up and down.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.
Sunsmoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. And I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.